And for the record, Your Honor, my name is Bradford Allen. My registration number is 11165. I'm pleased to represent Mr. Ogden. Probable cause is an essential element of the crime of vehicular homicide under the statute. 183106 specifically provides that proximate cause must be proven in order to convict someone of vehicular homicide. The legislature has also defined for us what proximate cause means. It means a cause which in natural and probable sequence produced the claimed injury. I'm going to briefly go over some of the facts in this case to show you why proximate cause was the issue in the case below. That was the primary issue presented, argued, and the issue upon which the mistakes were made by the prosecution, by the court, and in fact, in the final analysis, by the jury, because they, as you can tell from my brief, resorted to extraneous information to try to resolve the problem that was created by the district attorney's closing remarks and by the judge's refusal to clarify the confusion that was created earlier. All of these issues relate to probable cause. On August 20th at about 10 p.m., defendant was driving southbound on one of the major streets in Fort Collins. Now, the street has two lanes going south, two lanes going north, and a storage lane in the middle. He had driven this many, many times. He was on his way home. He comes up to the intersection where he is going to have to turn to go home, and he sees one block ahead a motorcyclist round the corner and begin to head north. Now, he had done this drive every day for years. He knew that intersection well, and he knew he had plenty of time to make that turn safely, and so he began to do that. Unknown to him, of course, that motorcyclist was a young man, new on a motorcycle, only had his learner's permit for 2 months, had a new crotch rocket type motorcycle. I'm sure he was excited to have that, and he accelerated rapidly in a way that no one could have anticipated. The speed limit in that area is 40 miles an hour. The police did an accident reconstruction, and they testified that that young man, the motorcyclist, reached between 84 and 89 miles an hour. So he accelerated rapidly, and he kept going in that right-hand lane. Remember, there's two lanes going northbound. He stayed in that right-hand lane and continued that acceleration up to almost 90 miles an hour. He did not brake. He did not try to move to the next lane over, which was open. He just kept going, and then he hit the very rear end of the defendant's car at almost 90 miles an hour. Again, no braking, no evasion, no nothing. And careened off and unfortunately passed away as a result of that accident.
Mr. Allen, one set of facts that you didn't tell us about was that the defendant had been drinking and had blood alcohol content way above what the limit was. So I guess the question that I'm interested in, and perhaps the rest of the court too, is that the statute says that the particular crime that your defendant was convicted of is a strict liability crime.
Yes, sir.
So tell me what proximate cause is in the context of a strict liability crime.
I'm glad you asked that question. I'll address that in some depth at this point. As we know, strict liability is an issue that deals with the mental state. It is not an issue that can redefine what proximate cause is. A strict liability crime, not unlike this all originates in kind of a same time as civil law. The cases here reference civil and criminal law in the development of the proximate cause concept. The proximate cause concept, actually, I'll go back and cite some of the cases for the court. The proximate cause concept is in criminal law. Now, the gist is a concept of the not-so-complex principle that the person normally should be deemed responsible for the natural and probable sequence of their acts, and the principle serves as an evidentiary function requiring proof by the prosecution of the causal relationship between the defendant's conduct and the result. That's from Rossi, which was quoted in the next named case, which I'll be talking about, the Supreme Court case in Garner. But, Your Honor, the first thing to point out is there is a distinction between the strict liability issues, which is what the mental state has to be in order to commit this offense, and the elements of the offense, entirely separate issue. When looking from a strict liability point of view, in other words, what the mental state has to be, the issue as determined by the courts is, did he act voluntarily? Was his action getting in that car and driving under the intoxication voluntary? That's the issue of strict liability as it applies to this case. I know that there are some cases, the Garner, the Grassy case, and the Stroke case, all of which bring these issues together in different ways. And I'd like to go through each of those cases with you to discuss strict liability and proximate cause and how these cases have been blended. Let me first state that, before I get to the cases, there is, of course, some language in these cases that talk about, for strict liability crimes of vehicular homicide, proximate cause means the voluntary act of driving. And again, let me reiterate, when we're dealing with strict liability issues, that only deals with the mental state. It is my argument to this court that the cases that talk about strict liability and proximate cause in this context neither intended to change the definition of proximate cause, nor could they have. They didn't have the authority to change the statutory definition of proximate cause, and especially in the way that they would have had to have done it had this definition been correct.
Are any of those cases Colorado Supreme Court cases?
Garner and Grassy, Garner is the Colorado Supreme Court. Rostad, the one that I just quoted from, is also a Colorado Supreme Court case.
So if the Colorado Supreme Court has said that's the way we should look at proximate cause, we can't ignore what the Supreme Court said.
Not, Your Honor. But let's look at that Garner case and see if that's really what they said, if they meant that. Because I would submit to you they did not mean to change the definition of proximate cause. It doesn't make sense for them to do that. But in looking at the Garner case specifically, they didn't do that. And actually, I'll jump to the Garner case right now, based upon your question, but I will want to get back to my analysis in just a moment. The Garner case said specifically that in looking at this issue, they had gone through and looked at the language when this statute was created. They looked at all the legislative bills and discussions, and I will quote directly from the Supreme Court's case. In 1977, the House Judiciary Committee hearing support this court's interpretation of the law in the Rostad case. That's the case that ties the criminal behavior to the result. In the Rostad case, there the bill was explained as providing that, quote, if a person voluntarily drives a car and is intoxicated, and that conduct of driving while intoxicated is the proximate cause of the death of another, then the person is guilty. That language specifically says, okay, we have this issue of strict liability, so we have to have that voluntarily drives the car. But that did not eliminate the requirement that the state prove proximate cause, that the driving caused the death.
Counsel, let me just ask about that in terms of the state's evidence. I believe there was evidence at the trial, as I understand it, testimony that the defendant cut the corner when he made the turn, and then if he had not cut that corner, there would not have been an accident. Doesn't that establish proximate cause?
Now, that at least raises the issue of proximate cause, but we weren't allowed to argue that because the state's closing eliminated proximate cause as an issue. They said it's a cause. On seven separate occasions, the district attorney in his rebuttal close, when I didn't have a chance to get back up and say anything, said as long as it's a cause of the death, he didn't say proximate cause, didn't say driving was a proximate cause of the death, he just said a cause, that is a misstatement of the law, then you must find guilt. So
you agree that that raised the proximate cause question. There's no question that when the elements were listed in the instruction that proximate cause was listed.
Correct. It was.
So your argument is based on the notion of the prejudicial effect of the prosecution's remarks during rebuttal argument?
Yes.
Okay.
Can there only be one cause?
There can be many causes. But they all have to be proximate causes if they're going to be found, if someone's going to be found guilty.
So what you're arguing about is that it was reversible error because the prosecutor didn't use the word proximate after the word a in his closing argument?
And he, in fact, eliminated the whole concept of proximate cause when he gave those two examples and say, hey, a perfectly safe driver doing absolutely nothing wrong can be found guilty of vehicular homicide if he is driving a car and an accident occurs and a death results. So there was no, in his argument, his discussion with the jury, there was actually no requirement that the driving be the cause of the death. And let me touch, Stroke specifically addresses that issue. Stroke specifically...
Well, the driving, in his hypotheticals, the driving was the cause of the death.
The but-for cause, we would agree. We're not dealing with a but-for cause, we're dealing with a proximate cause, a cause which in its natural and probable sequence causes the death. And our argument is that this driving in its natural and probable sequence did not cause the death. His driving was safe. And it is inappropriate to have driving be the basis for criminal responsibility.
Excuse me. Did the proximate cause instruction included language, it is a cause without which the claimed injury would not have been sustained.
Yes.
Did you object to that instruction?
No.
Okay.
That's in the statute, Your Honor, in the appropriate case law. I don't think that that's necessarily wrong. But I do think that when the jury comes back and says, we're confused on this, they ask four questions on proximate cause. And when they say they're confused and we come up and say, no, the DA's argument in rebuttal close was not legal, not appropriate. We need to clarify this issue. The judge refused to clarify it, cut me off several times, and did not let me do that in chambers. Let me also touch on, though, the third argument, the jury taking it upon themselves, now that they're confused by this issue of proximate cause, taking it upon themselves is really, I think, the strongest argument we have, and I'd actually look at that very carefully. They clearly went outside the information that was given them and relied upon information that had nothing to do with proximate cause. They just said, hey, there's driving an accident and someone dies. I mean, they eliminated proximate cause as a required element of proof, and it is an element that must be proven. That kind of jury misconduct is grounds for reversal. And, Your Honors, thank you. I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jillian Price, bar number 40815, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. This court should affirm Mr. Ogden's convictions for three reasons. First, the prosecutor's comments during rebuttal close did not rise to the level of plain error. Second, the trial court properly answered the jurors' questions. And third, the jurors did not rely on extraneous information in their deliberations. Now, with respect to the prosecutor's closing argument, and I should say it was the rebuttal closing argument, the prosecutor, in response to defendant's examples of proximate cause, gave several examples of his own. What the prosecutor said was, a person runs out into the street to retrieve a tennis ball and gets hit by a car. In one example, a sober person couldn't stop. In another example, a drunk person couldn't stop. Now, what the prosecutor said in the course of these arguments was that in both cases, the sober driver and the drunk driver, that was a proximate cause. Now, though these comments might have been inartful, these were not flagrantly misstatements of the law. They were not such to rise to the level of plain error. Instead, what the prosecutor is attempting to do is differentiate between where strict liability would attach and where it would not attach. In Colorado, the law of strict liability for the purposes of strict liability of vehicular homicide, proximate cause is the voluntary act of driving while intoxicated. So if we look at the prosecutor's examples, where the drunk driver hits the kid that runs out to get the ball, that's a case where strict liability would attach. Or it's a sober driver, sure, that's a proximate cause, but strict liability might not attach. The prosecutor's comments here, though inartful, were not misstatements of the law, and they did not rise to the level of plain error. With respect to the jurors' questions, the examples that the prosecutor gave might have led the jurors to become curious about what other types of vehicular homicide exist. The juror asked, are there other types of vehicular homicide that do not involve alcohol? In response to that question, the trial court narrowed the juror's focus back to the charges in this case, which is specifically vehicular homicide DUI. The trial court said the only crime that you need to worry about is that which would is that what you've been instructed on, which is vehicular homicide DUI? The examples that the prosecutor gave where a sober person might have been driving simply do not apply to this case. Because the trial court's instructions properly instructed the jury and gave them a proper statement of the law, there was no error in the trial court's response to those questions. Additionally, to the extent that defendant claims the jurors relied on extraneous information, that is simply not the case. The jurors' affidavit said that based on previous experience, the jurors said that, the law is that if someone is driving under the influence and has an accident and someone else dies, then that person is guilty. Again, this is not an artful statement of the law. These are lay jurors. They're not attorneys. They don't have the capacity to articulate black letter statements of the law. And this statement is based on their own internal experience, which we ask jurors to bring with them into the courtroom. Again, the law of proximate cause for the purposes of strict liability of vehicular homicide, proximate cause means the voluntary act of driving while intoxicated. The juror's statement is a layperson's interpretation of that law. There's no evidence that the jurors brought in any legal dictionaries, any articles, or anything else that would constitute extraneous information. They simply said, hey, based on my personal experience, this is what I think this means.
Price, was there any examination during voir dire of the juror about whether any of them had had previous experience with vehicular homicide?
I don't recall if that was part of the voir dire.
I take it such a question would have been permissible.
Such a question would have been permissible. Indeed, that's the kind of thing that we ask jurors at the beginning, if indeed any of them are lawyers, if any of them are police officers, if any of them are experienced with the law at that level, that their statements might be authoritative in the jury room.
Were any of the jurors, were any of the people who served on the jury law enforcement officials or lawyers?
I don't believe that any of them were. And the juror's affidavit simply said, based on personal experience, this is what they thought. If this person, and this is not the case, if this person had been a lawyer, then we might have a problem. That there's case law that indicates that that's the kind of thing that rises to a level of authority that might override a trial court's instructions. To the contrary, here, these are lay people that are simply rewording what is admittedly a complex issue of law into their own terms that they can understand and apply. There was no indicia of authority here that would elevate this to the level of extraneous information.
I know to a certain extent these issues are all interrelated, but I want to go back to the issue about the jurors' questions. There were four or five questions, I think, I can't remember which. Is there anything in the record or in the language of the questions themselves that indicate that the questions were prompted by the prosecutor's rebuttal closing argument, which is challenged here? And is that even a relevant consideration as a matter of law, one way or the other?
Well, I'm not certain that it is a relevant consideration of law, but to answer your first question, what the jurors asked they asked four questions, and if we look at the trial court record, page 189 is where they're located. The third question is, the definition of vehicular homicide, does it always include alcohol? Now, that could indeed have been prompted by the prosecutor's example saying, okay, a drunk driver couldn't have stopped, a sober driver couldn't have stopped. But I think the relevant issue here is that in this case, strict liability attached because Mr. Ogden was driving drunk. And that is the issue that the jury was to decide. That was the instruction that the trial court gave. And that indeed was the reference that the trial court gave the jury in response to that question. The trial court said the only definition of vehicular homicide relevant to the charge in this case is contained in instruction 13, which is, of course, the definition of vehicular homicide DUI. Now, additionally, the trial court specifically instructed the jurors that the fact that vehicular homicide is a strict liability crime does not eliminate the need for the people to prove element number 5, which, if we look at that element, is proximate cause, as well as the other elements of the crime of vehicular homicide. Therefore, the jury was specifically told on two separate occasions in the initial instructions and in the trial court's response to their questions that the people were required to prove proximate cause. Additionally, both attorneys, both the prosecution and the defense, referred to the definition of proximate cause as a cause which, in the natural and probable sequence of things, caused the injury. There's no question that the people had to prove this element. There's no question that the jurors were so instructed. And further, the evidence does show that the people proved proximate cause. It's undisputed that Mr. Ogden was driving. His blood alcohol level hours after the event was 0.195, which is well above the presumable limit for impairment in the state of Colorado. And also, the people's accident reconstructionist testified that if Mr. Ogden had properly made his turn instead of cutting that corner, the victim would have been past the point of impact. Under those circumstances, the people proved proximate cause, and they proved that Mr. Ogden committed the crime of vehicular homicide DUI.
Grice, let me ask you about the jury's first question. By asking their first question, may we please have better definitions of proximate cause and strict liability? Did not the jury express some confusion about proximate cause, and was it not the duty of the court to help them out with that confusion by providing them with a better definition?
Well, certainly. Proximate cause and strict liability, again, these are not intuitive concepts. They are difficult concepts of law. So I think it's natural that the jurors might have had some confusion about that. However, the jury instructions to which the trial court referred them did contain the correct definitions of proximate cause. Now, when a jury asks for information during deliberations, the only times that an additional instruction is necessary is if jurors cannot be adequately informed by the original instructions, or the request concerns matters that are not in evidence, or questions which don't pertain to the law of the case, or the request would call upon the judge to express an opinion on factual matters that the jury should determine. Now here, the original instruction properly informed the jury of the law of proximate cause. There were no matters not in evidence or questions which did not pertain to the law of the case. I mean, the jurors were simply asking, okay, what's proximate cause? And the request, if the judge had expounded on proximate cause, that would have called upon him to express an opinion on matters that the jury were to determine. So the trial court's reference back to the original instructions here was proper.
Ask you another question about Mr. Allen's comments on the Garner case. Mm-hmm. And the way I understand it, Mr. Allen is essentially saying that the court did not mean exactly what it said. The Supreme Court did not mean what it said when it said the voluntary act of driving while intoxicated establishes proximate cause in vehicular homicide cases. And it appears that that would mean that the people did not need to prove that intoxication affected the driver's operation of the vehicle in a manner that results in a collision. How do you respond to Mr. Allen's comments about the language the Supreme Court used in the Garner case?
Well, my reading of Garner is that the court did mean to say that vehicular homicide is that strict liability attaches when a driver voluntarily drives a car while intoxicated. I think that's exactly what Garner says. I don't think there's any confusion as to what the legislature intended, or indeed what the Supreme Court intended. After Garner, we have People v. Grassi, which admittedly is a Court of Appeals decision, which follows that language to say that vehicular homicide, strict liability attaches when a driver voluntarily drives a car under intoxication. I don't think that is unclear. I don't think there's any room to move around that holding, and I think Garner was fairly clear in that holding. And I think the law in Colorado is equally clear that the voluntary act of driving while intoxicated constitutes the strict liability crime of vehicular homicide.
So it's my understanding that Mr. Allen is saying that strict liability means one thing. It means intent. What level of intent do you have to have? Where proximate cause means something else. And that this language used by the Supreme Court conflates those two concepts. So does Garner mean that if you are driving while intoxicated and you are involved in an accident, you're done? That's it.
It doesn't matter what happened. You were intoxicated. You were involved in an accident. You are responsible, and your action and your conduct is the proximate cause of that accident.
Provided that your conduct of driving that vehicle is the cause of is a proximate cause, then yes. Now, what Mr. Allen, I think, is alluding to in his closing argument, he gave the example of an impaired driver, someone who's under the influence of alcohol, is sitting at a stoplight, stopped, not driving the car, and somebody rear-ends him, and that person that rear-ends him then dies. In that case, the person who's intoxicated is not, his conduct did not cause that accident. Let's assume that even though he's intoxicated, he's properly stopped at that stoplight. He's not driving. Let's say even his parking brake is on. Under that circumstance, that impaired driver would not be a proximate cause. However, that's not the case here. The case here, it's undisputed that Mr. Ogden was operating his car, he was driving his car, and he cut a corner, and he was intoxicated. Under those circumstances, there we have strict liability, and the fact that he was driving and the fact that he was intoxicated while he was driving, that is the conduct that forms that strict liability for the purposes of vehicular homicide.
So let me take that one step further. You've got the cutting the corner here. You've got the testimony by the accident reconstruction expert. What if he didn't have those two things? What if he's not stopped, he's driving, no evidence of speeding, no evidence that he cuts a corner? Is he liable for a strict liability crime under those circumstances?
He is, because again, the law states that strict liability is the voluntary act of driving while under the influence. And that conduct, that driving while under the influence, has to be a proximate cause of the accident. Now here, again, he's driving, and let's say that nobody was speeding. Let's say that he, even if he did make that turn correctly, if he's driving and if he's under the influence of alcohol, and somebody else, and there's a collision, and the victim dies, that is strict liability for the purposes of vehicular homicide in the state of Colorado. And that's exactly what happened in this case.
It's your position that as long as the car is stopped, that he's not driving?
Well, I think, again, this is a very, very discreet and specific example that I'm attempting to give to distinguish between the act of driving, where there would be a proximate cause, and being perfectly stationary and stopped. That's a very discreet example. And in this case, Mr. Ogden was driving, he was under the influence, and therefore he's guilty of vehicular homicide. Thank you.
And Mr. Allen, you have about 3 minutes.
Good, thank you. You know, in the examples that the court just asked, I think we agreed that the driving still has to be the proximate cause of death. I think the case law says that. As a matter of fact, Stroke specifically says that it was error for a district attorney in his rebuttal close to eliminate that out. And they said, no, that's right. We conclude the prosecutor's statements were erroneous because they did not require the jury to find that Stroke's driving while intoxicated caused the victim's death. So they have reaffirmed this proximate cause issue with regard to the driving and the death. There is no question also that this case law explains that you don't have to prove the intoxication caused the accident, but you still have to prove the driving was the proximate cause of the death. That's where the cases have come down. I think nationwide, that's also where the cases have come down.
Absolutely. You keep saying the proximate cause, and that's what keeps confusing me.
It's a mistake.
It can be one of the proximate causes.
Yes, exactly. Okay. But it still has to be a proximate cause. And the jury didn't get a chance to decide these factual issues that we've been discussing, cutting the corner, whether or not that's the case, because they didn't understand that proximate cause still had to be proven. They thought, hey, if you're driving, accident occurs, you're guilty, just as you gave me with those examples. And that is not the law. You still have to prove that there's a causal connection between at least the driving, not the intoxication, but the driving and the death.
How do you get around the fact, though, that they were properly instructed on that issue? So you keep saying that they never got to this. I mean,
they got one proper instruction, and the DA in his rebuttal close misstated the law 8 separate times. Then that demonstrated, and the court asked what was the prejudice here, or the jury's questions. The jury questions then show the prejudice of those statements. That confused the jury. They have to ask questions. And once that jury starts asking questions, there's no presumption they understand what's going on. And the judge then has the obligation of further explaining things. And the judge didn't do that adequately because then they were confused on that single issue. Do we have to, does proximate cause have to be proven? Somebody there said no, and they convicted my client.
Nowhere in your brief do you indicate what answers the court should have made to the question. So how was the court supposed to know what answers you now, and to this date, I don't know what answers you think the court should have given. How was the trial court to have known this?
Well, actually, if you look at my questions in response to question three, I kept trying to say, hey, the DA made misstatements of law in closing. We should talk about this issue greater. And then the judge cut me off several times and then said, this is how we're going to answer it. At that point, I shut up. Maybe I should have made a different record. But in fact, that doesn't really make any difference.
The judge, today, what should the court have said?
The judge should have said, the mental state, strict liability issue means that the state does not have to prove the intoxication caused the injury, but the state still has to prove that the driving was the proximate cause of the death. That would have clarified things much better.
Thank you, counsel. And thank both counsel for your helpful arguments this morning. This matter will stand submitted and opinion will be issued in due course. Thank you.